You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Folks, when's the last time you checked your credit scores? Because your scores may change more often than you think, and you should know what they are now and not from a year ago. You know what they say, information is power, and Credit Karma is here to help out. The best thing? Credit Karma is always free and there's no catch, no credit card needed. Go to creditkarma.com or download the Credit Karma app now. Again, that's creditkarma.com or download the app. And now, enjoy the podcast. I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. Friends, Romans, countrymen. Do you ever get tired of people comparing the United States to the Roman Empire? Usually with the implication that America is imminently approaching the same unfortunate fate. It's the kind of thing armchair historians bring up at cocktail parties, along with pointing out that Stalin killed more people than Hitler. But my guest today says the comparison is more than just a superficial cliché. He's an expert in Roman history who constantly gets asked that very question, is America Rome? And he points to some startling parallels between the U.S. and Rome in a new book called The Storm Before the Storm, The Beginning of the End of the Roman Republic. Mike Duncan is the host of the wildly popular podcasts Revolutions and The History of Rome, and today he has good news and bad news for us. The good news, America is not collapsing like the Roman Empire. The bad news, we're at the part just before the collapse. I know what you're thinking. He's going to say Trump is Caesar. Trump is Caesar. No. He says Trump is not Caesar. But he says many of the forces that drove Rome to ruin, including populist demagoguery, economic inequality, the erosion of societal norms, and arguments over who deserves to be a citizen, will sound very familiar to today's listeners. However, it's not all gloom and doom. He says there are some key differences that may offer hope, and he has some suggestions on how the American Republic can straighten course and avoid the same fate as the Roman Republic. Coming up with Mike Duncan, host of the History of Rome podcast, in just a moment. My guest today is Mike Duncan, who is one of the foremost history podcasters. His award-winning series, The History of Rome, chronicled the entire history of the Roman Empire over 189 episodes and remains one of the most popular history podcasts. He then embarked on an ongoing series called Revolutions, which explores various revolutions throughout history. Collectively, the History of Rome and Revolutions podcasts have received over 100 million downloads, and now he's written a new book that answers the question, is America Rome? It's called The Storm Before the Storm, The Beginning of the End of the Roman Republic. Mike Duncan, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Hello, thank you very much for having me.
Well, we were just talking before we went on mic here about where your interest in Roman history came from. Talk a little about how this all began for you.
But I always had this intention to be like a writer, I was going to get into like science fiction writing. I was going to get into sort of fiction. I was going to write novels. That's what was going to be the thing that I did. And when I went to college, you know, I got into like the English department because I was going to be like a writer, and being an English major never quite clicked for me. And what I discovered is that most of the people I was reading, like, you know, Vonnegut and Philip K. Dick and those guys, were really well versed in history and in philosophy. And they had incredibly interesting things to say because they had spent so much time like sort of studying like the breadth and depth of civilization. And so I was like, I'll do that. And then I'll turn it into books. And what happened is I just never made the pivot to fiction. And when I discovered I started really delving into Livy and Polybius and Plutarch and, you know, the guts of the ancient sources, and started up the History of Rome in 2007 to just I'll narrate a nonfiction account of the Roman Empire from beginning to end, which is what I wound up doing.
Yeah, the research that you were doing to write novels, you know, eventually you realized that the research is the thing.
Yeah, the research itself was so fascinating. Yeah. And there were so many, I mean, like you read like early Livy, you read, you know, the early history of Rome by Livy or like Polybius. You know, the stories that are buried in that material, they're just so good. They're so interesting. They're so compelling. Like their characters are great. The conflicts are great. The battles, not just physical, like military battles, but also battles between the patricians and the plebs over who's going to have control of Rome. Like all of this stuff is so interesting. And nobody ever knows about most of it because that material is so dry. That, you know, you give it to like a 20-year-old and say, here, you know, read Polybius. They're going to be asleep in like, you know, seven sentences. But for whatever reason, it clicked for me. And I was just like, if I can just sort of update the language here a bit and explain to people these stories from, you know, the 400s AD and the 400s BC, the 300s BC, before you get to Julius Caesar, which is kind of the one era of Roman history that everybody does know about.
Exactly.
That there's 1,000 years worth of material here and nobody else is using it. So I'll just take it.
So this book probably takes place just before the point where most people's reference for Roman history begins, right?
Yeah, it's the prequel to what everybody does know. Because if you started asking just like random people on the street, you know, what do you know about Roman history? Like just say things, you know, do free association Rome. They'd, you know, Julius Caesar, you know, Antony and Cleopatra, they'd probably say like Caligula, Nero, like those guys, those early emperors. Well, you bunch all that stuff together and it's like that's about 100 years, maybe 120 years is where most people's reference points for Roman history are. And you don't know anything before Caesar shows up in about 50 BC. And except for like Constantine, you'll get Constantine. Like people will say like, oh yeah, Constantine. But yeah, and so he's true. A couple of hundred years later. But most of what people know about it comes from a very specific about a century, a little over that. And so I just one of the big things I wanted to do with this book is explain the 50 years that came before Caesar, because it's not like the Republic was super healthy when Julius Caesar comes along, when Pompey comes along, when these guys have these great battles that destroy the Republic. It's not like everything was great and they just, you know, grabbed the wheel and yanked it off a cliff. The Republic had been already, you know, under pretty serious assault for a good 100 years before Caesar comes along. And I'm trying to explain how it is that the Republic got to the point where Caesar could just kind of push it over the edge.
You know, for most people, I imagine they think Julius Caesar, they think this great military conqueror, and erroneously equate Caesar with the glory days of the Roman Empire, not the decline of Rome. So did you find yourself in the position of having to maybe correct people's timeline and reframe their ideas about Rome a little bit?
When they emerge as the power in the Mediterranean, when they are Rome, is like the prologue of my book. So there is this connection between, you know, the Roman military apparatus and political apparatus and administrative apparatus becoming the strongest thing, but having that lead directly to the collapse of their republican system of government. And so it's really the beginning of the end of the Roman Republic, which is going to collapse within 100 years. But Roman civilization, when it becomes the empire, it gets taken over by, you know, basically military dictators is who's going to wind up running Rome. But like the glory, the golden age of Rome is a couple of actually 100 years down the road. So there is this interesting connection between Rome achieving supremacy and then completely losing its old republican values of participatory government and limited rule and, you know, one person not just calling all the shots.
Yeah, and I understand that the reason you focused on these particular few decades from 133 to 80 BC was it was sort of your answer to all the people who come up to you and ask, where are we in terms of the Roman timeline?
Right, yeah. When I was doing the history of Rome, it's a constant question. It's been a constant question my whole life. I don't know when people see, right after World War II, people are like, is America Rome? And so people ask me, is America Rome? And usually it's not, this is not an exercise in really rigorous history to say so it starts here and then this period lines up with this exactly. But, if you sit back and kind of look at the trajectory of Roman civilization from their founding through the expulsion of the kings, the creation of the republic, regional expansion, then sort of global expansion, there's plenty of decent parallels between the sort of the progress of Roman civilization and the progress of American civilization. And so if you were to say, okay, let's start them both at zero and project them forward, are we like a new thing? Are we just recently founded? We're not just recently founded. We've been around for quite a while. Are we just emerging as a regional power? No, that's already happened. Are we just emerging as a world power? No, that's also already happened. But has the Republic collapsed and been taken over by a dictator? everybody on both sides of the political aisle will say, if the other guy's president, then yeah, we've been taken over by a dictator.
Yeah,
but we haven't actually been taken over by a dictator yet. So there is a place between Rome achieving global domination, inside the Mediterranean, and the collapse of the Republic and the takeover by dictators that does have a lot of parallels between, I think, where the Republic of the United States currently finds itself situated. It's really worth studying. I think it can shed a lot of light on some of the stuff that we are dealing with today.
Yeah. We do have this tendency to want to say Obama's Hitler or Caesar or Trump is Hitler or Caesar. And probably people who read the inside flap of this book read that and then say, oh, well, that's where he's going with this. He's going to say Trump is a dictator. That's not what you're saying necessarily.
No, Trump is not a dictator.
Yeah.
There are, I think that we are at a point where there are enough norms breaking down and enough the Republic is being, buffeted by some pretty heavy storm winds. But no, I mean, Donald Trump is not a dictator. He does not have the power that, Augustus wound up having, and nor does it even appear likely that he would know what to do with that power, if he had it.
And yet we do see, like you mentioned a moment ago, this erosion of societal norms and these attacks on the justice system, free press, the judicial branch, all of which seem to echo this gradual collapse of what the Romans called the mos maiorum. Explain to the listeners what the mos maiorum was and why its gradual degradation had such a big impact on the empire.
So mos maiorum roughly translates as the way of the elders. The Romans did not really have an extensive body of written law. I mean, they didn't have a written constitution. They had written laws, but, compared to what we would consider to be a normal amount of written laws, like we have, you just go down to the local, a local city hall, probably has more local municipal codes than the Roman Empire or at this period, the Roman Republic had from a written law standpoint. So most of how they operated was on unwritten rules and unspoken modes of conduct, unspoken norms, where you just, if you lost an election, you were just like, okay, I'll step back and I'll lose the election. There were certain things you weren't supposed to do. There were certain ways that there was a comity that was involved. I'll come back. I'll try to get you in the next election, but we're not gonna overstep our bounds here, and I'm certainly not gonna stab you to death and try to take power. So there are all these things that are there. Nothing is against the law, but things are against custom. And it's a pretty strong custom. And so what happens early on in the book is you start having political conflicts between kind of an intransigent aristocratic senatorial nobility and these forces of rising resentful populism. And rather than sort of coming together as they used to solve problems, they start getting into these battles where people start stepping outside the bounds of mos maiorum. And they realize, like, oh, well, there's nothing illegal about having the popular assembly depose one of my opponents. There's nothing illegal about trying to ram through this bill. It's just like the way it was always done. And I'm just not going to act that way anymore. And 5 years down the road, then 10 years, 20 years, this is all snowballing to the point where now you have like literally armies running into each other, because at the end of the day, I mean, even us today, following a written law, like allowing a written constitution to have power over us, that's just an unspoken norm, right? There's there's no the force behind it is nothing but force. It's what, you know, for the Romans would have been the end of a spear. For us, it's the end of a gun. That's really where all political power lies. So once you start pitching aside all of these unspoken rules, the last thing that you discover is that even laws are merely an unspoken written custom. And by the end of the book, you have Pompey, young Pompey, you know, saying to some magistrates who are trying to stop him from running an illegal tribunal that is executing the enemies of Sulla, like, you can't do this. This is illegal. And Pompey says, cease quoting laws to those of us with swords. And that's wherein lies the danger. It's not just that today everything's going to blow up. It's that if you keep doing this and if you keep allowing it to happen, it will snowball, and we will eventually get to the point where, you know, somebody's going to say, cease quoting laws to those of us with, you know, Abrams tanks.
Yeah, I found that really fascinating in the book, this idea that they didn't have a written constitution. They didn't have a lot of laws to guide people's behavior and inform what was right and wrong. Was that maybe one of the fatal flaws, that everything kind of revolved around the honor system?
I mean, it clearly was. That clearly was a flaw that was potentially exploitable, that, yeah, you are relying on the honor system. But, like, you know, the other side of this is, you know, you can't legislate everything. You can't legislate behavior. every single part of behavior. There is a certain, like, unless we want to live in some, like, Orwellian dystopia, which, you know, there's that old, like, you know, that which is not compulsory is forbidden. Like, humans aren't meant to live under a system where that which is compulsory is forbidden. So you can't cover everything. So no matter what, if we're going to live together on this earth under some kind of government, if we're going to work together, there is an honor system that needs to be in play. We need to have some respect for that, because otherwise it's like Orwellian dystopia on the one hand, or just like pure anarchy with, like, you know, some horde of bandits coming around and just doing whatever they feel like. And I'd prefer to live, personally, I might editorialize here, I would prefer to live somewhere between those two extremes.
You say that the Roman Republic was a victim of its own success. What do you mean by that?
That gets back to the fact that their conquest of Carthage and their conquest of Greece, that triumph, them emerging victorious from centuries of conflict, really, as the most powerful force in the Mediterranean, that leads to a lot of these erosions of the norms. There's other things we can get into it that start being introduced. There's a massive run of rising economic inequality, where the riches that are brought in as a result of these conquests are being concentrated in the hands of the senatorial nobility. And poorer Romans and smaller farmers that are out there, who had been the traditional backbone of the Republic. It was I'm a Roman citizen. I own a plot of land, and that's the way we do it. Those guys started to go away. They started being pushed off their land and bought out by these senatorial families who are, you know, really have like all the gold and silver of the Mediterranean world coming into Italy. So they're phenomenally successful from an economic standpoint, from a military standpoint. But it really does start to fatally erode their political system. And I think it does take down their republican form of government. It was just unable to adapt.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Mike Duncan when we come back in just a minute. Folks, did you know that the average family visits 5 websites before booking a vacation rental? I know how that is. I'm a huge travel junkie. I've been to dozens of countries over the years, and I always spend countless hours online just researching destinations. But now you can spend less time planning your next trip and more time relaxing with Tripping.com, the world's number one site for vacation rentals. Whether you're looking for a cabin to get away for New Year's Eve, planning your next beach vacation in Hawaii, or that vacation in Europe where you'll live like a local, Tripping.com can help you find the perfect place to stay. Vacation rentals offer flexibility, perks and amenities that hotels don't, like multiple bedrooms, backyards, hot tubs, free Wi-Fi, and even fully stocked kitchens, so you can have a quick bite on the go or plan and cook your own meals. It's great for families and large groups. With Tripping.com, one search lets you filter, compare, and sort over 10 million available properties on trusted sites like VRBO, TripAdvisor, Booking.com, and more. Don't wonder if you're getting the best deal. You'll save an average of 18% per night by booking your vacation on Tripping.com. So don't forget, if you want to save time and money while booking the perfect vacation rental for your next trip, head to Tripping.com/kickass today. That's TRIPPING.com/kickass. Tripping.com/kickass. And now, back to the podcast. Now, among that working class and the plebs in Rome, did you see the same kind of populism and resentment toward the establishment we're seeing now? And did you see leaders who were trying to exploit that at the time?
Yeah, definitely. Because, like I say, this process of rising economic inequality creates out in the rural areas, you have these people that had owned these plots of land for generations. You know, mm-hmm. my great grandfather worked this land, and I worked this land, and now I've lost this land. They did have a sense that the way of life that they used to have was now over, and part of the reason why it was now over is because my bastard, rich neighbor has bought me out or is expanding at my expense. And there's plenty of stuff in the, that you're able to take directly from Appian or from Plutarch or from Cicero that are talking about these grievances. And absolutely, the first big showdown of the book in chapter one is Tiberius Gracchus and his Lex Agraria. Right. And what he's trying to do quite openly is like, I'm going to take land from the rich and we are going to divide it up and we are going to give it to the poor. And mm-hmm. that then opens up a much broader style of Roman politics. It's the populare style or a populist style of politics where you are going to go out there and tell, the urban plebs who would like to have some kind of subsidized grain ration or the rural poor who want land or, these equestrian merchants who have made a lot of money but aren't allowed into the political mm-hmm. system. Hey, we'll give you, a greater say in how the state is run. And a lot of it is specifically focused on lessening the power of the Senate, mm-hmm. lessening the power of that senatorial aristocracy. And that does become like one of the central conflicts of the Republic for the next 100 years. I mean, Julius Caesar is operating a populare style,
right?
Political campaign. That's sort of what he's planning on using to rise to power.
Yeah, and there was also a huge debate over citizenship and what makes someone Roman, right?
Right. And this is the other. So you have that side of things. It's like these battles between rich and poor. Mm-hmm. Well, when Rome conquered Italy. I mean, this is back in like the 300s. The Romans did not annex defeated cities directly into the Roman state.
Right.
So they would defeat some city in Tuscany or defeat some city in down in the Greco-Italian part of the peninsula. And rather than saying, okay, you are now annexed into us and you are Roman citizens, or even okay, we rule you now, and so we're going to send like a prefect or a commissar from mm-hmm. Rome to rule you. It was, you're still just an ally of Rome. Like, you are a subordinate ally, and you are in a Roman protectorate. But technically, you're not a Roman citizen. Yeah. You're not with us, and we're not with you. This went on for like 200 years, where the only thing that Rome ever asked from these cities was for those cities to provide men for the legions, right? It was kind mm-hmm. of a military alliance. So we'll let you run yourself, and we're not going to tell you how to do things. We're not even really going to tax you that heavily, if at all. The only thing we want from you is men for the legions. So then this unfolds for like 200 years where, by the beginning of my book, Italy really is knitted together as a part of Roman civilization. They're all in Roman civilization. It's just that the vast majority of them are still technically non-citizens. Yeah. They are still technically allies of Rome instead of being citizens of Rome. And by this point, by the 140s, the 130s, the 120s, the benefits of being outside the system have been far outweighed by the costs of being outside the system. So they want to try to push their way in. The Italians are going to be constantly over the whole course of my book, it's one of the big themes, asking for citizenship. We want citizenship. We want the right to vote. You know, we want the same legal protections that a Roman citizen has. We want the same political rights. You know, our, you know, rich local elites, we want to be able to have them be senators and go run for office and, you know, possibly represent our interests in this system. And the Romans, they really didn't want to do it. They didn't want to give the Italian citizenship. And that became one of the parts of the Populare platform, which is, you know, and also we will give citizenship to the Italians. And eventually it erupts into a full-blown civil war.
Well, you said that you weren't trying to match the U.S. and Rome point for point here. But I wonder, in that case, are there some significant differences between some of the things that applied to Rome in those days that maybe wouldn't be relevant or wouldn't apply today?
I think one of the big differences, and when you say, like, you know, is America Rome, are Americans the Romans, there is a huge gap between a conception of progress versus conservatism. Okay, my point here is that the Romans, especially the political leaders, were very conservative, small c conservative in their outlook. Mm-hmm. They didn't like a lot of change. They didn't want.
Right.
They wanted things to be the same. Yeah. They wanted their sons to live the same, to be protected. They liked the way that things were. And you know, one of the reasons why they were so resistant to reform is not just that they thought it would be, you know, an immediate threat to their whatever financial interests or economic interests, but that, you know, we don't do reform here. We're Romans. We plod along and we want things to be the same. And so that was actually a huge, you know, like one of the big problems for the Republic was that it was unable to adapt to the new sort of imperial system that it was running. They were still trying to run Rome like it was this little clubby city state in Italy, and not really, you know, taking a step back and looking
up,
and be like, look, we're running Spain and we're running Greece. And, you know, we're already into what is today modern day Turkey. They were still trying to treat it like it was this little clubby thing that they were doing. And they were really hyper focused on who was up and who was down inside the Senate without really looking at the bigger picture of like the health of the state. Mm-hmm. So that conservatism, I think, really hindered their ability to adapt successfully. Mm-hmm. So the other side of this is that I don't think that Americans have a problem with changing things, with reforming things. We're much more adaptable in that way because, you know, the United States is a product of what the Enlightenment. Let's look at how things are and see where we can improve them. Let's use our rationality to improve this, and we'll prove this. And we just sort of take it for granted that things are not perfect and that things can always be improved. Mm-hmm. And, you know, whether you think it's a tax cut or a tax hike, we're never going to just say, let's just keep things the way they are permanently. So when it comes to, like, can we adapt to our changing circumstances?
Can we
address reforms? Are we going to get bogged down in these same things? I don't think that we are hindered in that same way. We're hindered by other things, but we're at least not hindered in that same way that I think that the Romans were.
So how do we learn from history so we don't repeat it? How can we prevent the United States from having the same fate as Rome?
Well, the first thing you want to do is buy my book, The Storm Before the Storm, The Beginning of End of the Roman Republic, and then buy many copies for
also
your friends and loved
audio.
Ones. Yes, all of it's available as an ebook. It's on audio. So you definitely want to read my book. But it does a lot come down to, even if you're not just reading my book, trying to engage with history to give everybody just a broader perspective on things. And I think right now, I mean, the 24-hour news cycle isn't even a thing anymore. We are on about a 10-minute news cycle.
Yeah.
And it is revving so fast that it is very hard. Like, I used to say that we live in a 6-month bubble where anything that happened more than 3 months ago is ancient history. Mm-hmm. And anything that happens more than 3 months in the future is like so far in the future, we can't even deal with it. I mean, we are down now to like a day. Like stuff that happened last week is like ancient history. Stuff that's happening next week is like, well, we can't even get to that yet. Like we have 58 news cycles to get through between now and the end of the day.
So there's this force now that's kind of working against people taking the long view of history.
Oh yeah. I mean, it is like between Twitter and Facebook and the speed with which everything is working, it is really destroying our ability to have perspective. Mm-hmm. So even beyond just like, is there a specific lesson you can learn from what happened to the Romans? Just even if you open
taking
a book and read something about that happened 200 years ago, or better yet, 2,000 years ago.
Yeah.
Like, this is why I love ancient history, because it, even if it doesn't directly impact, even if there's not a specific lesson that you learn, like, you know, always pay your mercenaries, right? That's an important lesson. An important lesson that we learned in the history of Rome, is that you're always supposed to pay your mercenaries on time. Don't stiff them, because then they'll kill you. But even if it's not specific lessons like that, it's just being able to see a bigger picture and see that, you know, not everything is happening on a 30-second cycle.
Yeah, and it's been said that the doors of history swing on small hinges. I wonder, when you look at current events yourself or current cultural trends today, do you find yourself looking at those small hinges or prognosticating about where some seemingly minor thing might lead us?
I can't even keep up. I don't think that any one of us really has the ability to grapple with all the little things that are happening simultaneously, and it will
so many distractions.
Yeah, but that's the thing. What is a distraction? Is the distraction a distraction from the distraction, or is this other distraction? Like, I mean, not to get too far down the specific things that we're dealing with, but like, is the idea that the president of the United States has possibly been put into office by foreign meddling and people in his inner circle actually have like financial and political ties to a foreign government who doesn't have our best. Is that a distraction from, you know, a massive tax cut that is specifically designed, or is the tax cut a distraction from the fact that, and you're like, I can't make heads or tails out of this. And it seems all important. And in, you know, 50 years, 100 years, 150 years, when historians look back on this period, I will be genuinely curious about what verdicts they start to come to. It's like, oh, no, this was actually the thing that was important, and that thing over there was actually a distraction. it's such a cloud of dust right now. Humans have emerged from dust clouds before. Like, things have, you know, we can get through it. But yeah, I can't honestly make heads or tails out of what is going on right now in the world. I certainly couldn't predict what is going to be considered important or not important to a historian 100 years from now.
Yeah, and you're right. It is hard to suss out what is important and what's a distraction, because the news media is so entertainment-based that we gravitate toward the stuff that's entertaining or funny, that's Melania Trump's Christmas decorations at the White House.
Exactly.
A news cycle.
And that's the problem, is that a lot of it, so I guess I can't say this, a lot of it is gossip, right?
A lot of it
functions no differently than any sort of tabloid gossip, because it's easy. It requires no reporting. You know, you just have to kind of like make some snarky. Like, there is even you take something that is ostensibly real, ostensibly about, that looks like it's something important, like, you know, Trump, Pelosi and Schumer just last week, they didn't go to the White House because Trump said something snarky about it. Okay, well, I mean, this is kind of important. You have the two leaders of the opposition party now refusing to have a conversation with the president, but it's all very gossipy.
Yeah. And, well, at the end of the day, it's a photo op.
Right. Nothing was going to come up anyway. There was just one the other day, which is, Trump is, you know, been calling aides into his office for private meetings and giving them assignments like behind John Kelly's back. And like, okay, I mean, that's important. I guess that there's that the White House which is, you know, ruling the country, is not working particularly well.
Yeah.
And you know, the president's going behind. But it's gossip. Like, this is gossip. And that's what it is.
Yeah, I think
it's
you
no
really
different.
Hit on it.
It's no different from like a high school. It's like, you know, oh, who went behind whose back and who's not going to stand next to each other in the school photo. And you're like, none of you guys, like, this honestly doesn't matter.
Stuff that has no particular inherent value in and of itself is suddenly news. slaves.
Right. And this is something that like this that actually doesn't have much to do with the Roman experience because they didn't have they didn't have like a press or a free press
right.
or anything.
But they
like
had
this.
Gossip, I'm sure.
Oh, they. Oh, God. I was just joking about this with a friend of mine. That yeah, like Suetonius is gossip. You know, like a lot of what we take as Roman history is it mm-hmm. can have those kind of salacious, gossipy yeah. stuff. Like yeah. the stuff we know about Nero and Caligula. Yeah. Like a lot of it is like, was he really doing yeah. that? But
I don't know. I heard Caligula had tiny hands.
No, he was little boots. Little, he had very, oh, really? Had very feet. Caligula means little boots, so he had very little feet. No, he got that when he was a kid. But yeah, the degradation of the press, really, with the arrival of the internet, we still have not been able to properly grapple with mm-hmm. what the internet means for news reporting, mm-hmm. and our ability to fund and operate, you know, a press corps that would actually do investigative journalism and report on things, rather than just what is easy, which is to write a clickbait. Because I mean, yeah. if you're a young reporter, you know, you got like 30 minutes to crank out some other thing that's going to get clicks. And what's easy? It's gossip about mm-hmm. you know these guys. What's hard? Actually digging into the issues.
Yeah.
Which, don't get me wrong, if you're an older member of the audience listening to this, I'm not trying to say that gossip wasn't a huge part of newspapers back in the day. Of course it was, but I think we can all agree it's gotten quite a bit worse.
Well, before we go, I think that if there's one hopeful takeaway from this book, it's that
there are no hopeful takeaways. Well,
there have to be.
There are no hopeful takeaways.
For me, the hopeful takeaway is that you're focusing on the period before the fall of Rome and saying that that is where we're at. We're not living in the age of Caligula. Nero isn't fiddling while Washington's burning right now. So in some sense, there's still time to change course before it's too late.
I agree with that. Yes. There is some hope that's in there. And it is true. I don't think that we're too far gone. Mm-hmm. I don't think that anything is inevitable. I don't even necessarily think it was inevitable that the Roman Republic go the way that it went. Mm-hmm. There's certainly a couple of adjustments that they could have yeah. made, you know, in theory.
Which makes it a cautionary tale.
Yeah, it's a cautionary sense. Tale yeah. of what happens when, you know, an intransigent elite refuses to reform in time to save the system when, you know, if you have, you know, legitimate grievances from a population of citizens and also non-citizens who are having their lives thrown into absolute turmoil by forces well beyond their control, you know, what is the state's response to this? Mm-hmm. If it's to close ranks and try to protect their own power and privileges, then you're really running the risk of major political upheaval. I mean, not just mm-hmm. and I know this not just from writing this book, but also from all my work in revolutions. Right. This is a fairly reoccurring pattern that if a population that is being buffeted by forces beyond their control find no relief from the state and not even the appearance of that state caring, that it destroys the legitimacy mm-hmm. of the governing apparatus. You look at the state and you say, this isn't even working for me, so why should I have loyalty to it? If you're a pleb who's been dispossessed of their land and you're getting nothing from the Senate, then when the Senate collapses and the Republic collapses, you're not sitting there saying, oh, I lament the fall of the noble Roman. You're like, yeah, screw those guys. They were nothing but good for. In fact, you know what? I'll go bash one of their heads in and take their stuff. It's fine. You know, the French Revolution operates on, you know, many of these same principles. I'm doing the revolutions of 1848 right now. It's the same thing. It's like the beginning of it, the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. And you have these old conservative rulers in Europe who were not able to adapt and address mm-hmm. most of the social, you know, the social upheavals that they were that they were facing. So the lessons of revolutions and the lessons of this book is that, you know, power is, you know, for better or for worse, it's in the hands of a small minority of leaders mm-hmm. and, you know, financial and political leaders. And it's in many ways up to them to have foresight. You know, if anybody needs to be reading history, it's not necessarily just the citizen who's out there, you know, trying to go to his, you know, 40-hour a week job, increasingly 50 or 60 for the same pay, or not able to have a job at all because you're working this other guy for 60 hours a week. You know, that it's the leaders who could mm-hmm. use some broader perspective and to stop with their little, you know, their gossipy myopia of the Washington, D.C., you know, set. And if they could read, if I could put this book in the hands of of everybody in the Senate and in the House of Representatives, I think that,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, but it would be nice if they would pay for it.
Oh, sure, yeah. Well, they're rich.
Congress,
they get things for free. That's the whole point. This is another recurring pattern in history where there's a thing where
the people who have get more.
No, and if we're wrapping this up, I'll end this with a fun anecdote, okay, which is that so the equestrian class, which is a class in Rome just below the Senate, was called the equestrian class because they were the guys who were rich enough to afford a horse for the army. Mm-hmm. So they were the cavalry. So if you were rich enough to own a horse that you could go serve in the cavalry, then you were called an equestrian. And you would be enrolled in the equestrian order. And what happened is that once you were enrolled in the equestrian order, then after a couple of decades, you started being provided a horse at the state's expense. And it became this sort of like social distinction. Oh, do you have a public horse? Right. Yeah. Ah, yes, I have a public horse. Why do you get a public horse? Because they're rich. They're the only people who were rich enough to afford a horse are now the only people who are being provided a horse at the state's expense. So, there's a long recurring pattern in history of being rich enough to get other people to bear your costs for you, which is still going on today, of course.
Yeah. So that was the movie star swag bag of those days.
Exactly. Yeah. It's like, yeah, you're the only person around who could actually afford to buy this. And you're now, of course, the only person who's going to get it for free. Oh, well, of course, we'll comp this meal for you, you know, Mr. Billionaire. It's like, God.
Yeah. Well, once again, folks, you need to learn from history and buy Mike's new book. It's called The Storm Before the Storm, The Beginning of the End of the Roman Republic. And you can listen to Mike Duncan's History of Rome podcast and Revolutions on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Mike, thanks for talking with me.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks again to Mike Duncan for coming on the podcast. Once more, you can order The Storm Before the Storm, The Beginning of the End of the Roman Republic on Amazon, or download the audiobook at audible.com. Subscribe to his shows Revolutions and The History of Rome wherever you listen to podcasts, or visit revolutionspodcast.com and thehistoryofrome.typepad.com. And follow Mike on Twitter at Mike Duncan. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at Kick-Ass News Pod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and ideas at comments@kickassnews.com. I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.